Happy Friday. This is the takeaway for July 28th, 2017.
This is a disappointment. A disappointment indeed.
Let me say it's been a long, long road for both sides.
After midnight, we're gonna let it all hang out.
You're seeing this skinny bill get fatter and fatter.
This is becoming overly complicated.
This is insanity.
After midnight,
regular order.
We're gonna travel and shine.
I would say to my dear friend, the majority leader, we are not celebrating. We are relieved.
We're gonna call talk.
I'm not gonna vote for a pig in a poke.
Senators voting in the affirmative. Graham, Capito, Cassidy. Senators voting in the negative.
After midnight.
Collins, Murkowski.
We're gonna let it all hang out.
McCain.
Defending this nation is our first priority.
I am voting no.
After midnight.
I believe each of us stood for the reasons that we felt were right.
So now I think it's appropriate to ask, what are their ideas?
After midnight.
It'll be interesting to see.
It's gonna be peaches and cream.
We're at this point. Turn the page.
We're gonna cause talk.
Mr. McCain.
No.
After midnight. We're gonna let it all hang out.
You can hear it right there, the gasps in the moment Obamacare repeal died in the United States Senate. This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry. Thank you for being with us. And that moment was how it ended. Last night, as Senate Republicans tried for the fourth time this summer to fulfill their 7.5-year mission to repeal the Affordable Care Act. Days of intense negotiation, after weeks of backroom deals, after months of planning, ended after midnight, when three Republicans voted against their party. Arizona Republican John McCain, the one-time presidential candidate, back in the Senate this week after receiving a diagnosis of brain cancer, joined two other Republicans, Susan Collins of Maine, Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, and just like that, Republicans had 49 votes, not 50. Vice President Mike Pence was in the chamber lobbying and leaning on senators and ready to break a tie on behalf of President Trump. But it didn't matter. Those three Republicans joined Democrats to kill Obamacare repeal for the foreseeable future. It was a stunning political moment for everyone, and especially for Republican Senate Leader Mitch McConnell.
This is, clearly a disappointing moment. From skyrocketing costs to plummeting choices and collapsing markets, our constituents have suffered through an awful lot under Obamacare.
Mary Ellen McIntyre is a healthcare reporter for CQ Roll Call, and she had eyes and ears on the Senate floor last night to explain how it all went down.
Senator Collins of Maine voted no, as most people had expected. Senator Murkowski, who had also voted no on repeal bills earlier this week, also voted no. And then John McCain, who, when his name was called, hadn't voted, went down to the well. He gave the thumbs down, and that was it. He had voted no against Obamacare repeal.
Mary Ellen, why these votes no? I mean, Republicans had billed this latest effort, not really as a healthcare policy, but said, look, we're having a lot of trouble. Don't let repeal die. It's too important to Republicans. It's too important to President Trump. Pass this little skinny thing that we have on the floor and let's get to a negotiation with the House. Let's just keep the process moving. So why do Murkowski, Collins, and then McCain say no?
So Senators Murkowski and Collins had been basically against everything that had begun on the floor earlier this week. Both of them were very concerned as to what this would do to their constituents in Maine and Alaska. And they were both really concerned with the process. Senator Collins has been calling for weeks now, let's return to regular order. Let's do hearings. Let's have markups. We shouldn't be crafting such a major bill that's going to overhaul the health care system in this country without any hearings on it. Senator McCain was a little bit different. He voted earlier in the week to start debate. He'd voted to advance a repeal and replace plan, but he'd voted against a straight repeal plan. And then Thursday, he wouldn't say earlier in the day how he felt about a skinny repeal bill. He said he wanted to speak with his governor, Arizona Governor Doug Ducey. He said that he was very concerned that the House would just take up this legislation and that he didn't want this legislation, the skinny repeal, to become law. Later that afternoon, he held a press conference with a couple of colleagues saying, if the House can give us assurances that they will go to a conference committee, that this won't become law, we will vote to advance it, but this is bad policy. We don't want this to become law.
The blow-by-blow story there of how Obamacare repeal failed in the Senate late last night. Well, with this chapter of the healthcare saga behind us, a lot of people are wondering, is it really over and where do Republicans go from here? For more, we turn to Brian Beutler. He's senior editor at The New Republic, and he's been watching the healthcare debate for a long time.
You can never say never when you have a unified government, and a unified government from a party that has been talking about wanting to repeal Obamacare for, as you said, going on 7.5, 8 years now. And it's, in, I suppose, theoretically possible that they could reconvene and regroup and before the end of this Congress pass something similar to the legislation that they've been looking at for the last few months. But the way Mitch McConnell ended the debate, both in his words and in his procedural actions, and just in the fact that Republicans have basically kind of ticked down a list of possible options and haven't been able to find majority support for any one of them, it really does seem like the end of the road for this.
So how did we get, though, from a Republican Party that triumphantly passed, 40 or 50 versions of repeal votes over the last many years, and in fact, a Congress that passed repeal that President Obama was forced to veto, how did we get from that self-assurance and that unity to this political disaster that we saw last night?
There's an expression that's gone around a lot since Donald Trump unexpectedly won the presidency, that the Republican Party is the dog that caught the car, which is a way of saying that as long as Barack Obama was the president, Republicans made opposition to him their sort of organizing principle without much thought to what the promises that they were making through their opposition to Obama would mean should they unexpectedly become the governing party in the country. So that meant opposing Obamacare, promising to repeal it root and branch, promising to dismantle it. And at some point, facts on the ground began to emerge. People became insured. There was a moment after the 2012 election when Republicans thought about walking away from repeal, knowing that people would soon start getting the benefits of the law and that in 2016 it might be too late to pull it out. But the internal politics of the Republican Party made that impossible. So they continued to claim to want to repeal the Affordable Care Act without thinking about what it would mean if they actually did it. Once Donald Trump became president, voting to repeal Obamacare stopped being a mobilizing tool and started being something that would actually impact constituents. And when it came time to vote on this final measure, the facts were there. 16 million people would lose their insurance, premiums would go up 20%, markets would fail in many states, and that ultimately wasn't something that the party as a whole decided that they wanted to have attached to their name.
So what does it mean now then, Brian, before we let you go, to have spent all these many years promising this thing, to have built your political platform on repeal, and now you still have to govern or try to govern knowing that you failed?
We're going to have a clash between a faction of the Republican Party that wants to stabilize the Affordable Care Act, make it work better for people, and basically call detente on the healthcare fights, and a more Trumpian faction that wants to try to collapse the Affordable Care Act through regulatory means in the hope of bringing Democrats back to the negotiating table to hash out a different plan.
That's Brian Beutler, senior editor for The New Republic and host of the Primary Concerns podcast. And we also heard from Mary Ellen McIntyre with CQ Roll Call. We want to get a Republican perspective now on what went on in the Senate and what it means for the future of the party. Ryan Williams is a Republican strategist and a former spokesman for Mitt Romney's campaigns in 2008 and 2012. Ryan, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you know what it's like. Your old boss knew what it was like to be caught in the middle of a Republican healthcare debate. Here we are so many years later, and you've got a party that's torn itself in two over repeal.
I actually worked with Governor Romney in the governor's office when we passed the Massachusetts healthcare bill, and it was a difficult process. It took months, but it took leadership, and it was a difficult fight. It took leadership from the corner office, and Governor Romney was able to get it done. And I think what we're seeing in Washington right now is, despite the fact that there is one party control in the Congress and in the White House, we have a president that really doesn't understand the policy details of this legislation and is not taking the kind of active role that you'd expect from a president to get his legislation passed. Governor Romney did that when he was the governor in Massachusetts. And even though I don't agree with him, President Obama took a very hands-on approach to get Obamacare passed about 8 years ago. So I think we're seeing what happens when there's a lack of executive leadership involved in a legislative fight over an issue as serious and as complex as health care.
There's a political reality at play here that's probably bigger than whether Donald Trump is on the phone to Congress.
Well, repealing Obamacare is something that Republicans have promised ever since it was passed. It's been the cornerstone of our election victories in 2010 and 2014 and again in 2016. So it's something that we knew we were going to have to address. Now, has it been a perfect process the whole time? No. Is repealing any kind of an entitlement program difficult? Of course it is. Anybody who's involved is going to face backlash. That's why it's so important to get this right and have a leader in the White House who can make the sell. It's not an easy process, even though we do have both houses of Congress to get this done. It requires the president rallying public support for it by selling the plan, going across the country and selling the plan to rally support for the repeal and replacement of Obamacare. And that's not something that he's done in the same way that Obama did it 8 years ago when he went around the country and discussed the plan and laid out why this is the right thing to do despite opposition. So, yes, it is a difficult process, but that's why you have an act. You should have an active president to not only sell it to the public, but also to convince members of his own party to take the tough vote. And we've just not seen that thus far.
And what do you think it means for the political future of the Republican Party now? I mean, lots of members will protect themselves in their own elections, but this is now a party, of course, that is in full control, as you mentioned, and at least for the foreseeable future has failed to fulfill its 7.5-year promise.
Well, I don't think the party should give up on repealing Obamacare. Speaker Ryan put out a statement today saying that despite the loss last night, they're not going to give up. But that being said, I think that we do, if we can't get health care, we do need to rack up some wins on other issues like tax reform, you know, spending cuts, tax pocketbook issues, helping to create jobs. We need to show some degree of legislative success heading into 2018. And hopefully President Trump will learn a lesson from this experience that he does need to really study up on the details. He does need to go sell whatever plan it is, whether it's health care or tax reform, to the public in order to get results. And hopefully he'll be more active, engaged, and familiar with the details of other pieces of legislation going forward, because Republicans do need to show the American public that we can govern, that given the White House, the Senate, and the House, we can get things done for the American people. And if we don't, that's going to be a very difficult thing for us to overcome in the 2018 reelection campaign.
Do you think that these senators, Murkowski and Collins, watching the president and how he handles his staff and how he handles his presidency, are intimidated enough in the future to go his way when he issues threats?
No, I don't think they're intimidated at all. And I think that's because this is a president with a 36% approval rating at this point in most polls. He doesn't have a broad level of support that is really one of the big intimidating factors when you're trying to, you know, if you're trying to muscle a member of Congress. If you're a popular president, you've got more sway than if you're an unpopular president. And, you know, polling has showed that, you know, while I as a Republican do believe we need to repeal and replace Obamacare, the process is unpopular. And that's because the president has not gone out and made it popular by selling it.
Ryan Williams, Republican strategist, former spokesman for Governor Mitt Romney in his presidential campaigns. Ryan, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
It's Todd Zwillick. Welcome back to The Takeaway. And let's go now to a scientific first in the United States, one that could play a major role in reducing genetically based disease. Scientists in Oregon have edited genes inside living human embryos for the first time. They did it using a breakthrough gene editing technology called CRISPR that was developed in 2015. This was an experimental lab. No babies were born, but the promise of being able to edit genetic diseases right out of an embryo's DNA could be a major step for healthcare. But if disease genes can be edited, other genes can be edited too. And the breakthrough also raises the possibility of designer babies, allowing parents to pick the kinds of desirable genetic traits they would like for their children. Art Kaplan is with me now to talk about the medical promise of this new technology and the ethical concerns around it. He's director of the Division of Medical Ethics at the New York University School of Medicine. Dr. Kaplan, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Well, gene editing in vitro has always been, Dr. Kaplan, this kind of sci-fi dystopia idea, but it's been increasingly obvious that it was close to reality. How big of a deal scientifically is this?
It's a big deal. It's obviously still a long way from having a super baby designed for a wealthy couple. You know, we don't know if this technique is going to work. We don't know if it's safe. But going into human embryos and engineering something, that's a major step. That is a major step.
Now, this was the first time in the U.S., but where else has this been going on around the world, and how efficient is it?
Well, China has had a couple of scientific teams report embryo editing, but they used embryos that were intentionally disabled. That is, you couldn't put them inside a woman. They wouldn't grow. They shut off other genes. This report, and remember, we still haven't seen the paper. It's just a leaked report that somebody has done this, involves embryos that, in theory, if you put them inside a woman's body, would develop into a fetus and ultimately perhaps a person.
So there's a very clear scientific upside here. There's also an ethical upside and an ethical downside. Let's start on the upside and the kinds of diseases that might be editable here with this new technology.
So we have a variety of ailments that really occur in humans because of a single error in DNA alphabet. That is, it's called a point mutation. It just means there's one typo that's causing trouble. Think sickle cell disease, hemophilia, cystic fibrosis. If you could find a way to edit in the right letter, repair the typo, you could, in theory, repair these diseases, prevent them at the embryo stage, kind of subjecting the embryo to genetic surgery. That could do a lot of good because not only would you get rid of the disease in the individual, you might get rid of it in their offspring, thereby ultimately perhaps getting rid of genetic diseases of some kinds in human beings forever.
Now, of course, some diseases have one or two typos. Most don't. Most have hundreds or thousands or more. So given this accomplishment, how far are you away from much more complex diseases that have genetic components or really complex genetic origins?
Yeah, good question, and pretty far. You know, basically the technique is just in its infancy. It sometimes puts letters in where there aren't typos. Those are sort of target mistakes. We don't know what the error rate is yet, much less what that might do in terms of safety to a child born with that kind of engineering. So I'm going to say for the foreseeable future, meaning 5, 7, 8 years, at most you're going to see people try to go after small typos, single mutation type diseases. Now that would keep them pretty busy, but we're not going to get to the complicated ones for a while because that involves more changes across the entire DNA alphabet that each one of us has, introducing the danger of a higher risk rate.
Then there are, of course, the ethical downsides or the gray areas, Art Kaplan, and you know where I'm going with this. How many desirable baby traits, like gorgeous little eyes or the chin that you want, are the kinds of point source mutations that you're talking about? And how long will it take to be able to design a baby with the features that you want?
So I think people are really worried, and legitimately so. Remember, we have a history when it comes to genetics. Nazi eugenics, American eugenics, excluding people based on their ethnicity, which was a genetic immigration restriction, laws against interracial marriage in many states here, again, a eugenic type consideration. Eugenics has occurred. That said, most of the qualities that people I think would want, smarter, stronger, faster, probably involve a number of genes. So I'm not exactly worried that we're going to see eugenics in the next decade, even if we pursue this technique to treat diseases. The time is now to decide if we want to criminalize, prohibit, set limits on where you can go with respect to genetic engineering for improvement or enhancement, because we do have time. We're not going to be there for a while.
Is that a debate and a set of restrictions that you think need to take place now?
I do. I think the time is to have that debate right now because it's going to be very controversial. Remember, there are many people who would say, if I could improve my child's memory, if I could enhance my vision in a child, if I could make my child have a better immune system and resist diseases, then let's do that. I want to do that. It's not clear that everyone will find improvement and enhancement immoral or wrong? So we're going to have to really debate this and get settled on it. Plus, we have to put the penalties in place. Are you going to jail if you try to do this? Would any journal publish a paper in a prohibited area? So a lot of work to do. Time to discuss that is now, but I'm going to say I wouldn't hold up the disease research on the basis of saying we've got to settle the eugenics issue first. We have time with the eugenics issue. We can decide to pursue disease prevention, and I think both can go on at the same time.
The scientific possibility and the ethical dilemma of the new technology of in vitro gene editing. Art Kaplan of the New York University School of Medicine. Thanks, Dr. Kaplan.
Thank you.
Never apologize, mister. It's a sign of weakness.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
I'm sorry I lied to you, but you lied too.
Sorry I had a fight in the middle of your Black Panther party. You would like to apologize?
I'm sorry. I forgive you.
It's Friday, and that's movie time here on The Takeaway, and that means Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday, and The Takeaway is here. Hi, Rafer.
Hey, Todd.
Rafer, they told me I don't have time for trivia today. Lucky you.
Oh,
I think you just got off easy.
Spare my weekly humiliation, Todd.
We'll do that. We got three movies, though, today. Atomic Blonde, starring Charlize Theron. She's a spy at the collapse of the Berlin Wall. We've got Detroit going back 50 years to unrest and riots in 1967. And Al Gore is back, an inconvenient sequel, Truth to Power, all about climate change, of course. Rafer, let's start with Atomic Blonde. I mentioned Charlize Theron. James McAvoy is in this. Here's a clip.
I'm not going to lie. I'm impressed.
All right, Charlize Theron there. But I saw this trailer, Rafer, and it's really got Jason Bourne-level action all over it.
I'm going to say Jason Bourne-level is sort of an understatement for this film. This is really one of the best action films to come along in years. The director,
wow.
David Leitch, former stuntman turned director, he contributed to John Wick, which was a hit a couple of years ago. Theron is just amazing in this film. I really can't say enough good things about it. It's such a fast-moving, fun, fresh film set in the 80s, right before the Berlin Wall, as you said, and it's got this great sort of punky new wave sort of decadent feel to it. Great soundtrack, New Order, Depeche Mode, all the period specific hits that you remember.
Fantastic.
And again, the action in this film, there's a scene in this film that I think is going to become very famous that people are already calling the stairwell scene. I won't say any more, but it is just a stunner, and I absolutely love this film.
Great. Well, I'm excited then. And it looks like the kind of film also that might have Atomic Blonde 2 now that Charlize Theron is an action star.
Indeed.
Let's talk about Detroit, Rafer. Kathleen Bigelow got famous for a lot of movies, especially Hurt Locker. Here's a clip.
Fellas, you know, sometimes when a black guy is put in a position of authority, other black guys, they like to single you out. Okay, because I'm not supposed to tell them what to do.
Rafer, we're back in Detroit now, 1967, at the time of the 12th Street riots.
Right. That's John Boyega playing a real-life character, a security guard named Dismukes, who is he's been trying to sort of keep a cool head during the infamous Algiers Motel incident when Detroit police burst in looking for a gun and a possible shooter and in the end shot three unarmed black men, or, well, I guess I should say at least two. One death was never explained fully. This is a familiar story, sadly, and it comes at, I guess the timing of this film, sadly, is kind of relevant. It's extremely intense, as you might expect from a Kathryn Bigelow, Hurt Locker, Zero Dark Thirty, really puts you there in the middle of the Algiers Motel and really makes you feel the terror, the reign of terror from the police. I would say I kind of wish this film had told me a little something new about this issue of police brutality and racism and police tensions in black communities. It doesn't quite do that, but it does leave you with this feeling of anger and outrage and kind of helplessness, which I think is part of the point. I think it really wants you to feel what it was like to be one of these people in that motel, and it does that very effectively.
Thanks, Rafer. All right, that's Detroit from Kathryn Bigelow. Rafer, we're going to have you hang around, if you don't mind. Before we take a quick break, just give me a go, no go on Al Gore and Inconvenient Sequel.
Well, I think viewers are going to split down partisan lines on this one, which is too bad because I think there's a lot of interesting information in it. But whether it will change many minds, I don't know.
Thanks, Rafer.
The Takeaway is supported by Netflix, presenting The Incredible Jessica James, a new romantic comedy starring Jessica Williams and Chris O'Dowd, now streaming on Netflix. And by the Arkansas Economic Development Commission, and the state committed to acting quickly and decisively on corporate interests. Learn more about how Arkansas works for businesses at arkansasedc.com.
Welcome back. It's Todd Zwillick and Rafer Guzman of Newsday, and with us here at The Takeaway is still with me. Hi, Rafer.
Hey, Todd.
Rafer, you've been diving into a new film called Menasha that's coming out. Now, this takes place in the Borough Park neighborhood in Brooklyn. It's home to one of the largest Orthodox Jewish communities in all of the U.S. That's where this film Menasha takes place. It's coming out in theaters today. And Rafer, you saw this film.
Yeah, I did. It's a lovely film. This is a drama cast almost entirely with Hasidic actors living in Borough Park, speaking mostly in Yiddish. And it's really a window into a community that we never get to see, and a community that is very separate from, you know, the secular world. The director was telling me that not only was this the first time that many of these people had been in a film, but it was the first time that many of these people had even seen a film.
And who is the title character? Who is Menasha?
That's Menasha Lustig. That's the actor. He plays a guy who has lost his wife. His wife died, leaving him with a young son. But because of rabbinical law, he cannot live with his son unless he gets remarried and raises that child in a two-parent household. And this film is essentially based on Menasha's real life, his real story, his real situation. I got a chance to sit down with Menasha and with the director, Joshua Weinstein, and I asked him, what drew him to this project?
It was the impossibility of it. It was the fact that it had never been done before and that probably will never be able to be accomplished again. And this was a society that we see every day in the city, but it purposefully does not want to interact with us. And so we think we should interact with them. But what happens when you cross that divide, when you cross that bridge? And I was endlessly fascinated and curious. So every day I was on set, I learned something new about the world and about humanity and about Hasidic Jews.
And how did you find your star, Menasha?
There are hundreds of thousands of Yiddish-speaking ultra-Orthodox Jews in the tri-state area, and only about 60 showed up for auditions. There's only negative repercussions that could happen for being in this film. So when these 60 people showed up, I would do intense improv sessions with them just to see what their quirks were, how they responded, what the camera looked at them. And immediately, when Menasha came in for an audition, I was blown away that he had this Charlie Chaplin-esque humor to him. But at the same point, there was deep sadness inside him. And he told me just two details about his life that ended up influencing the entire course of the rest of the film, which was, one, he was a widower, and two, he didn't have custody of his son. And those two details informed the emotional journey that the film was going to go on.
And Menasha, what did you think when this guy said he wanted to make a movie about you and starring you?
I was thinking that I don't want to be a star. I want to be my own. I want to be as I am and act. It should be in a kosher way. I believe that there should be a way how to do that.
This movie, you know, it's about your fight to keep custody of your son, to live with your son. Tell me, why aren't you allowed to keep him? What are the values of the Hasidic community that say it's so important for him to be raised in a two-parent household?
It's not about the religious or the community. It's more, we have to think more logic. I was using my emotions. My emotions, I want to be close to him. And more than this, it's what the whole movie was. Officially, it was like fighting for my son. But unofficially, it was like searching for some satisfaction. My satisfaction is my son. He's my whole life. So who should gain? Who should lose this time? So that was the whole fight.
I think in the film, there's a character. I think it's Isaac, the uncle, your brother in the film, and he says the Gentiles have broken homes, and so they have a broken society. And I think not too long ago, many people would have agreed with him. But I think America has come to accept a single-parent household, different parenting arrangements, different definitions of a family. Do you think that there'll come a time when the Hasidic community will also develop new ideas of what a family is? Do you think they should?
It's very hard to answer this because I'm not a spiritual leader. But as far as I'm reading and learning, I believe that we don't have to understand everything what the Torah and the religion says. We see things happening and people succeed in the wrong way according to the Torah. Could be for different people different. So it could be today is the fact that it's more divorce, more people apart. People learned how to deal with the problems even and they're in deep in the situation. But of course, normal house would have two parents.
Joshua, let me ask you a question about the filming of this movie. You said you basically had to film it in secret within the community. How is that possible? Didn't people notice a film crew in the community of Borough Park? Didn't people, the actors, talk amongst themselves to their friends and neighbors?
The film was incredibly difficult to make. I mean, because there's so many scenes in this movie that we've never seen before. Documentaries could not have access. We had to recreate it. So it was important for me to shoot in real supermarkets, real streets, real shuls. Like, actors would drop out days before showing up to set or the day of. They refused to come because people pressured them not to be in this film. So we were always so aware that people involved with this film had intense risks. And the secretness of it for us was that we want to protect these people because for them, they want to express some base human needs and desires through acting. I mean, we all want to express ourselves. And for the people who made the sacrifice to be involved with this film, it was worth it to have the opportunity. But Menashe, he doesn't think that what he's doing is wrong. You know, when Hasids first came to America after World War II, telephones were illegal. Then tape cassettes were illegal. Then CDs were illegal. So every time a new technology has emerged, it's immediately is considered unkosher. And then there's slow acceptance. And Menashe, part of his fight is that he sees there's a future of making kosher films.
I'm not Hasidic, of course. So while I was watching this movie, you know, and you're struggling in this film so hard to keep your son, my first thought, of course, is, go, you know, leave, take your son and go somewhere. That's obviously a big step. Did you ever consider that yourself in real life?
People telling me all the time, but I grow up there, and the place where you live is your best place all the time, where you grow up. I am Hasidic. Could be I'm not practicing everything. I try to dress. When I'm there, I try to dress like them, and I try to do whatever I could. But I hang loose, you know. I love the place. And I have to be realistic. My son also have to be in this kind of, I can't change him too, because I want to change, I will change him, it will destroy him. So if I want people should help him, should help me, I have to be between friends. Moving away from a place after a tragedy is a kind of suicide.
This movie is such a love letter to your son. Has he seen it?
My son, no.
No.
If he will beg me to see it, I will show it to him. I'm very open to him for this. The second he will ask me, but he didn't ask me, and it's up to him.
I've been talking with Joshua Weinstein, the director of Menashe, and his real-life star, Menashe Lustig. Thank you both.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. It's Todd Zwillick. And a quick story, if you'll let me, about a musical punch I got in the face as a kid. I was about 15 years old, maybe 16. My friend and I were there, two kids, in Hershey, Pennsylvania, listening to tapes from down in D.C., you know, the kind with the handwritten labels on them. We were turned on to something that wasn't on the radio, and it wasn't on repeat at the high school dances we used to go to. And then one Saturday in the spring, we drove down to D.C. for an afternoon show, all ages, at 930 F Street in Washington, D.C.'s old 930 Club. They stuck a black magic marker X on your hand at the door to show no drinking. And that was the first time I saw the D.C. punk scene and the first time I saw Fugazi. When we have the thing. Whoa, these guys weren't talking about who they wanted to dance with or that they're never going to give you up. No, they were mad. They were mad about corporations. They were mad about money over people. They were mad about racists. And the kids, we stood on the side at the 930 Club because we were outsiders. But the kids in the crowd looked like a family. And that was on the East Coast, of course, a punk awakening for me. But 3,000 miles away in Northern California, they had already had their punk renaissance, the sharp edge of punk in the late 70s in the Bay Area, where a movement was born.
We loved it because it was something new, fresh, that wasn't the Eagles, wasn't Led Zeppelin, and wasn't Saturday Night Fever.
That's Jello Biafra, the frontman for the Dead Kennedys, talking about the birth of the San Francisco punk scene in a new film. It's called Turn It Around, The Story of East Bay Punk. Corbett Redford is the director and the producer of that film, and he says the ethos around punk that developed in the Bay Area at the time was this willingness to say what you mean and say it without fear. And that stuck with punk for decades.
There was already this kind of vibe of resistance going on. And a lot of punks, I think, they condemn the hippies. You didn't get the job done. You know, the revolution fell flat. But at least in the Bay Area, a lot of the punk kids, their parents were activists or authors or professors at the university. So there really wasn't this typical punk plight to condemn the hippies. It kind of morphed into the art school there, the Institute in San Francisco. Bands like Dead Kennedys and Avengers started cropping up. Crime, the Nuns.
So you've been to school for a year or two, and you know you've seen it all.
And Bill Graham, who was the kind of, you know, monolith rock promoter in San Francisco, he did not like punk. He couldn't stand it. So punk culture kind of got maligned to playing at a Filipino supper club called the Mabuhay Gardens. It was like the CBGBs of San Francisco. So the birth of punk in the Bay Area happened in San Francisco, but slowly as the culture started to change, it went over the Bay into Berkeley and Oakland.
Talk about Bill Graham. You mentioned him, the massive legendary promoter in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. He didn't like punk at all, but also kind of gave a rallying point of hatred for a lot of punks to organize themselves around their hatred of him.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, it's very interesting. Vicariously, I found out the beginning plight to form the 924 Gilman Street Punk Music Collective in Berkeley happened because of something that Bill Graham said to Tim Yohannan, the publisher of Maximum Rock and Roll magazine out of San Francisco, a punk periodical that's been around for 30 plus years. He had an interview with Yohannan on KPFA radio and said, "All right, you kids, you want a place where you can break things and spray paint on the walls? Fine. You know, you go find it and I'll fund it." So Tim Yohannan and Jeff Bale and Ruth Schwartz, they all went out to look for this place. They came back to Graham and they said, "Here, you know, we found this place." And he says, "You've got to be kidding me." Vicariously, he actually, the place where that launched Green Day and Rancid and Operation Ivy, Neurosis, all of these fantastic bands, ultimately came to be because of a fleeting dare by Graham.
There's a war coming down between my breasts and mine. I don't want no war.
Well, let's talk about the music a little bit. In fact, let's talk about the music a lot because it's one of the best parts of this film. Jello Biafra says in your movie, he's the front man for Dead Kennedys, of course, says in this way that only he can, you know, before 1977, all you had was the Eagles and Zeppelin and Saturday Night Fever and ELO. And he's saying that music, even if it was good, like Zeppelin, didn't have anything to say, at least not to him.
I love a lot of those bands, but it could be said that there was such, you know, a litany of that stuff coming out, and it felt kind of bloodless. You know, it was all overproduced, and you couldn't hear the energy and the humanity in it, I guess. And so something needed to break. I think the same thing wound up happening when Green Day got big or when Nirvana got big. You know, you had a lot of the hair metal and the 80s rock that was going on, and Nirvana just blew those doors open and really spoke to young people and the disenfranchised, because you could kind of hear something in it that really hit your heart.
Would you believe me when I tell you you're the queen of my heart? Please don't deceive me when I hurt you. Just ain't the way it seems.
Somebody says in your film, I can't remember who, that sometimes it can be hard to tell just how good a punk rock guitarist really is.
Right.
What does that mean, and why is that?
I think that when people think of punk rock, they think of this very simple kind of chord progression. They think of, like the Ramones. What people don't understand is that what the Ramones did themselves was change the face of rock and roll. When you take that simple structure of a punk song and you start kind of being adventurous with it, like people like East Bay Ray or of the Dead Kennedys or Tom Flynn of Fang have done, something completely new comes out of that.
So let's talk about what punk is today, Corbett. Green Day helped produce this project,
yes,
as you mentioned. You talk a bit in the film about the commercialization of punk, and of course there's no way around the fact that a lot of fans consider Green Day the poster child of commercialization.
Right.
They consider them sellouts. They've been called worse. You know that.
Mm-hmm.
So what about their role in that? What about their role in this film?
I would say that to anybody who has the argument, you know, punk is different things to different people. This is a public service announcement. This is only a test. Emergency evacuation protest. What we have to do is look back at, you know, the beginning punk bands, the Sex Pistols, the Clash, the Ramones, Blondie. These were all bands that were on major labels, right? And just like they did back then, bands like Green Day getting big, or Offspring, or you know, Rancid, who stayed on an independent, actually. The bands that did sign, they created inroads to the culture for millions of people, just like those early folks did.
The film is Turn It Around, the story of East Bay Punk. Corbett Redford is the director. Corbett, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And that's all for us today. But one final note, we want to congratulate Takeaway engineer Vince Fairchild and his wife Sage, who've just welcomed the newest member of the Takeaway team into the world. Their son, Elliot, was born yesterday afternoon. And Elliot, we're going to give you just a little bit of time before we start training you on that board and training you how to hit those posts in live radio. Elliot, welcome. We're happy to have you. Vince and Sage, congratulations to you. Thanks so much for listening today. Have a great weekend, everyone. I'm Todd Zwillick in for John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity with a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving, training programs that draw from 50 brain games, and tools to compare scores with global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com.